Welcome, everyone, to our review of Parshas Vayeshev 5777. We're calling tonight's class Yaakov, Jacob's Dreams of Tranquility, of Shalva. Let's begin at the beginning of the Parsha, which we get the name of the Parsha, Vayeshev. So it says, source 1, Vayeshev Yaakov, Jacob dwelt, Be'eretz Megurei Aviv, Be'eretz Canaan, in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan, Genesis 37:1. Rashi in source 2 explains what's happening here, and we're going to come back to this Rashi at the end. Scripture, the Torah described Esau's settlements and his generations, meaning in last week's Parsha, in Vayishlach, but only briefly, because they were not distinguished nor important enough to elaborate on in detail how they settled and the order of their wars or how they drove out the Horites, the Horiti. In contrast, it, the Torah, elaborates at length on the settlements of Jacob and his generations and all the events that brought these about, since they were considered important enough to God to dwell upon at length. Similarly, you will find regarding the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, so-and-so begot so-and-so. But when the Torah reached Noah, it dwelt upon him at length. Likewise, with the 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, it dealt only briefly with those 10 generations. But when it reached Abraham, it dwelt upon him at length. This can be compared to a pearl that falls into the sand. A person searches in the sand and sifts it with a sieve until he finds the pearl. And when he finds it, he casts the pebbles from his hand and keeps the pearl. So what does Rashi, it's very beautiful, and we'll come back to this, sort of saying the following. You get to Maaseh Bereishis, the story of Genesis, very succinctly, very tersely told, 250, 300 words. Then you have the generations that take us from the Garden of Eden to Noah, 10 generations. And they're the begats. So-and-so gave birth to so-and-so, lived so-and-so much amount of years, and had children. Here's the significant child. And then he died and lived so-and-so after. Okay. But then, when it gets to Noah, it slows down and gives us in detail the ark, the flood, the story. And then again, Viter. On we go to get from Noah to Abraham. And we get to Avram Avinu, once again, you're in Lech Lecha, and you have Parshas Lech Lecha, and then you go from Lech Lecha instantly into Vayera, and then Chayisara, which is really all Abraham, and then transitioning to Isaac, told us is Isaac. And now, the most egregious example, we get to Jacob, and Parsha after Parsha are named for Jacob and Jacob's family, and all the minutia of what happens with the family. So this is a question we have to deal with. It seems on the surface very strange, almost counterintuitive, that the big things, I don't know how the world became the world, all those generations, which is kind of a mystery to us today, how we get from Adam to Noah, Noah to Abraham, now, instantly, just boom, boom, it just chick-chuck goes through them like they're just data, statistics. But when it gets to significant people, it's almost like it's at warp speed, and then it goes back to normal speed for a minute. The starship slows down. Let's analyze. And once we finish the analysis in detail, let's get to the next seminal event. This is something I want you just to keep at the back of your mind for a moment, and we'll come back later tonight. Number 3, Jacob dwelt, by Yeshev Yaakov. And this is the Rashi, the second Rashi on this first verse, that's going to set the tone for tonight and the question tonight. The dreams that Jacob had to live a life of tranquility, of shalva. Jacob sought to dwell in peace. Shalva, tranquility. But then the ordeal of Joseph sprung upon him. The righteous, tzaddikim, seek to dwell in peace. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed is, he said, wait a minute. The righteous do not consider that which is prepared for them in Olam Haba, in the world to come, to be enough for them? That they need to dwell in peace in this world, Olam Haza also? Rashi says, no, you're going to have a lot of rest when you get to the next world. This world is a world of movement. It's a world of engagement. Now, obviously you can ask a myriad of questions, but I think this is the question we have to ask about Yaakov, Jacob. Did Jacob really desire tranquility? What does shalva, what does peace mean? Now, think about Jacob for a moment. What is his alter ego? Israel. He just won the name through what? War, battle. His name means that you fought. Kisarisa. You engaged. So you mean to tell me that Jacob lives his whole life? First, he's persecuted by big brother Esau. Then he's persecuted by his wicked uncle Laban. And he perseveres and he overcomes all. Comes back to the promised land. Tzaras everywhere. Didn't get to see his mother again. Rebecca Rivka died in his absence. So he never gets reunited with his mother, who sent him away. It was very sad. Comes back. And last week we recounted the meeting, the famous Pikishah, that momentous moment where the two brothers are brought face to face. So now after all these amazing events in his life, which you could argue, are they good or bad or indifferent, but they were the formative years that made Jacob become Israel. So he's at the height of his superpower, so to speak, as Israel, newly anointed as Israel. And what does he want to do? He wants to go to Florida and kick his feet up on the beach and retire? I mean, I don't understand. It's a very strange Rashi that he wants this type of peace. So that can't be. It cannot be Jacob. Let's look at source 4. And we quoted this. Your name shall no longer be Yaakov, but Israel. Kisarisa, for you have struggled. Im Elokim v'im Anashim, with God, meaning the angel of God, and man, referring to Lavan and Esau, according to Rashi. And you won, Vatuchal. You overcame all adversity in your life. So after he wins the mantle, Israel, now he's going to retire? Now granted, he's been through a lot. He is prematurely old. Where do we see this? When he meets Pharaoh, which comes in 20, you know, whatever years henceforth, he meets Pharaoh. Pharaoh has never seen an individual look this aged. And he says, oh my gosh, how many are the days and years of your life? It's a famous meeting when the kings meet. The king of this world, Pharaoh, meets the king of the next world, Jacob, that's at the end of Bereshit. So he is prematurely aged through the process of life. And of course, losing Joseph for all those years does not help. But the question begs itself, how could Jacob even desire peace and tranquility? What does that really mean? Doc?
Well, that's the whole question. To dwell in peace doesn't mean that you're going to sit the lip back, put your feet up, and watch TV the rest of your life. It means that you have projects you want to do and kind of accomplish without anybody bothering you. You want to get your
excellent
your purpose.
Excellent. Could not have said it better. So what Dr. Kalman said is perfect. He doesn't want to retire, quote unquote, to Florida. But as you said, he's had all of these issues in his life that have prevented him from really getting down to business. He wants to get down to business now. He wants to have these cosmic, huge projects that as Father Israel, now he can get involved in something meaningful. And it's so much tzoras. Come on, Esau's out now. Laban's out of the picture. All the tzoras, all the bad things happened. But now he wants to just myopically concentrate on building our world. That's what Jacob is desirous of. And for that, you need some type of modicum of tranquility and peace. Perfectly said, Doc. Now, does he get this? Absolutely, tragically not. But before we get to number 6, which shows us he doesn't get this, look at number 5. What a great quote from Mishlei, from Proverbs. Better is a dry morsel with shalva, with tranquility. By the way, don't read it as halva, you know, that stuff from Israel, that stuff, the delicious. Oh, okay. Right. So you can read it as halva. Better is a dry morsel with halva, and it really is good. Good stuff. Probably the most fattening thing ounce per ounce in the world that we know of, most cholesterol and sugar. But it is worth it. Better is a dry morsel with shalva, with tranquility, than a house full of feasting strife. I love how they use the words feasting, because it's talking about food. So better, you have morsel, a little dry morsel of food and water, bread and water, in other words, without any fancy adornments. At least you have peace and quiet. Mm-hmm. To sit with a marvelous buffet with state-of-the-art cooks and chefs bringing you food, but there's a cacophony of sound, and we've all experienced this. There's that famous kosher restaurant, which will go unnamed tonight in New York City, right near Times Square, actually. It's a steakhouse. Great food. But whenever I've gone in there, it is so loud. and you're sitting so close to everyone. They're literally, like, I'm sitting here with my wife, and someone is on a date, and they're sitting like 18 inches away from us to our right. That's not good. It's not pleasant. There's no ambiance of tranquility and quiet, and that's what we're looking for. That's what Jacob wants. He doesn't want familial strife. He doesn't want brothers and uncles and all the tzaras, his wives fighting about who's going to write. He wants to leave all that tzaras behind, all that pain, and just get down to business. Let's build the Jewish people. But he doesn't get it. Look at number 6. Jacob escapes Esau. Yeah. But right away comes the tzara of Dinah. Dinah's kidnapped. She's violated. And the whole thing with Shimon and Levi wiping out the city of Shechem to bring back their sister. And then we learn later, it's not actually mentioned in the Torah, Ki b'charbi. Jacob says, I had to fight those guys. Those Canaanite neighbors came looking for revenge, and I had to pick up my sword and fight these guys. So I won Shechem fair and square. So first he goes through Dinah, after living a life of Lavan and Esav and all the tzaras. And then what happens? You figure Dinah's over. He finishes the tzara of Dinah, and along comes the tzara of Rachel, of Rachel. He loses his wife at age 36. He's a widower. After all this tzaras, you figure, okay, enough, dayenu. He wants a little respite. No. Along comes the tzara of Joseph. Yosef is torn up by the wild animals, or worse, we don't know what happened to Joseph. He's gone. Then it gets worse, because he loses Shimon. Shimon is locked up in jail back in Egypt. He may never see Shimon again. And then the tzara of Benjamin, Binyamin, is taken away forcibly. The only chance the brothers have to bring Shimon back is to bring little Binyamin, the last remnant of Rachel, alive today. Binyamin's gone. All of this. I actually was going to call tonight Soros, and more Soros in honor of December the 7th. Remember the movie, Torah, Torah, Torah? So I was going to have Soros, but I wasn't sure how obscure that reference would be. But that was my thought. I had it on the word processor. I eliminated it. So it's Soros, and more Soros. So poor Yaakov, poor Jacob. He just wants, as Dr. Kelman so perfectly said, he wants to build Israel. He's now Israel. Let's build the cosmic things that we're supposed to bring to our wonderful world. No. Pettiness, hairstyles, all the horrible things that break apart his family unit, and nuclear option that blows apart the 12 tribes of Israel. So let's discuss this. Number 7. There's an amazing quote in the Gemara in Shabbat, Maseches Shabbat in the Babylonian Talmud. Number 7. Amazing quote, because it's so true to our lives today. For $2 of extra material that Jacob gave to Joseph and became the Technicolor Dreamcoat and Donny Osmond on Broadway, his brothers became jealous because Joseph got preferential treatment. And that became a sign of Jacob's love for Joseph that just drove the brothers batty. I'll prove this to you in a second. One thing led to the next until our fathers, Yarad Mitzrayma, they went down to the land of Egypt. All as a result of $2 extra material sown by dad as a gift to Joseph. I mean, think of the tragedy of our world today. Kina, the jealousies that destroy families, that destroy the Jewish people, tragically, we're always our own worst enemy, right? We're always, invariably.
Isn't that one of the reasons that they were angry with him, because he used to snitch on his brothers?
He did. Yeah. He did. It says, Diba Samra, he brought back bad reports about them, El Avihan. Without going into too much depth, thank you, Rivian, it's a good question. There were a lot of things that brought this toxic dynamic between Joseph and the brothers. Joseph did his share also to exacerbate it. But in defense of Joseph and in defense of the brothers, we're dealing with very high-level tzaddikim, very righteous people. So legend has it, the Medrash says, that, for example, one day he was out and he saw his brothers eating a piece of meat. This is going to get a little graphic. I'm sorry for anybody who hasn't eaten dinner yet. And the meat looked like it was still twitching, like it was still alive. And they ate it. And he thought, oh my gosh, what have my brothers done? Because one of the 7 Noahide laws is called Aver Min Hachai, the limb from a living animal. Even though it was before Kodem Matan Torah, was before the Torah was given, there wasn't a death penalty or anything. But the 7 Noahide laws were right there. They were all the children of Noah, even before Sinai. They were bound by those 7 laws, and one of them is not to eat that. Now, what had in fact happened is the brothers had just shechted the animal, had just ritually killed the animal correctly, and they were eating the meat. I guess one of them was sick and they needed to eat it. Now, don't go into the whole laws of blood, but until the blood is drawn forth and comes back, you could eat an animal literally raw, not appealing to me, like unless you're into blue steaks like they have them, right? But apparently the brothers did not transgress the rule. Rather than confront his dear brothers and say, hey guys, did I just see you eat limb from a live animal? And they would have defended themselves and said, what are you talking about? What did you see? Oh, well, I saw, right? No, no, no. He went back to his father. He said to Yaakov, I think I witnessed our brothers doing this heinous act. That was his mistake, meaning it wasn't wrong for him to report to Jacob what had happened to try to get the brothers on the straight and narrow. But what was inappropriate is this halacha of ocheach tochiach, that when someone does something wrong, before you go to the authorities and report them, which is their dad, maybe you go to the guy and say, hey, did I witness this, or am I taking things out of context? That was one of the issues there. And that was one of the reasons the brothers felt validated in their feelings against Joseph and that he was deserving of being killed. Why? Because there's a law called Edim Zomamim, when a person's a false witness, gives false testimony against others. So let's say you have two witnesses come, and they testify against a guy named Reuven that he murdered this person. Capital punishment is the sentence, correct? But before they take Reuven out to be killed, two other witnesses come in front of the court, in front of the Sanhedrin, and they testify, hey, wait a minute, how could those first set of witnesses have witnessed Reuven kill this guy? They were with us in Macau. We were gambling all night long. We were 20-hour plane ride away from the scene that they claimed they were at. So the halacha, it's actually a very fitting rule. The rule is whatever punishment the two false witnesses tried to have Reuven subjected to is actually given out to them because they tried to literally murder him. So it's a phenomenal law, right? How does this relate to us? Because if Joseph, in fact, went to Dad and he was erroneously reporting, almost like a false witness, if you will, that the brothers were committing this capital crime, the brothers felt validated in their own minds that he was Edim Zomamim, he was a false witness trying to get them killed. It wasn't enough that he was number one in the family in Dad's book, but now you're trying to get us literally killed to run out of the family? They felt that their position was valid to have a court. They enacted a court, and they held that he was deserving of capital punishment. Of course, it was all changed because Reuven and Judah saved the day. Thank God they didn't kill him, but that's why they sold him. Just give you a little background. Okay, getting back right on topic then with number seven. So for $2 extra, that becomes the marvelous Broadway play, Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now, I promised I would prove to you that that was the object of their hatred. When Reuven comes up with his amazing plans, brilliant, he says, wait a minute, I can't allow my brothers to murder Joseph. He's not deserving of this. I'm the oldest, and I'm going to get blamed by Dad. I have to take responsibility here. So he says to them, look, don't touch him physically to harm him, but rip off that coat and do whatever you want. And so it says, Vayavshitu, and in fact, when you read the words in the Parsha this week, it's like you feel the violence that they committed, but not bodily violence. Violence against his Technicolor Dreamcoat. It says, Vayashitu es kutanto. They rip off that coat and they rip it to shreds and they throw unceremoniously Joseph into the pit. So that act probably relieved at least Levi and Shimon, who were the ones prone to violence. It relieved them of that need to, God forbid, kill Joseph. And Reuven was a pretty good psychoanalyst, you know. He knew what the brothers needed. So they took that coat. That was the symbol of everything they had contempt for Joseph. It was for that coat. I want it. And they ripped it to shreds, thereby kind of venting that rage against the coat and not Joseph bodily, which I think is a pretty smart thing. So what's the question we're asking? How in the world does Jacob desire a Florida retirement? And we answered, thanks to Dr. Kelman and your insights, that really he wasn't desirous of like retirement necessarily. He just wanted to get down to business. Business of being the first of the children of Israel. Let's build a nation. Instead, just when he thought all the tzoras was in the past, all the bad stuff that had happened to him prior to this, Joseph stolen, Shimon, Benjamin, 22-year nightmare thinking that Joseph is dead all these years. He's inconsolable. So what's going on? What happened? Let's go on. Number eight. So now we go back to Maisa Bereshit, to the beginning. We alluded to this at the very outset. We said that God creates a universe, but how many How many words does it take to summarize this creation? Yeah, just a few hundred words. But every act of creation, God dubbed the act. He sanctioned it. Tov. And at the end, he said it was even tov me'od. It was really good. Right? God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good. I'm giving you all the quotes from Bereshit 1, 1, 10, 12, 18, 21, 25. And then finally, Bereshit 1, 31, Perek Aleph, Lamed Aleph. God saw that everything that he had made, the hine tov me'od. Okay, I ask you a question. When God dubs something good, in other words, you get a test from God, you get it back, okay? And you get a grade, and he writes on it, tov me'od, job well done. Where is there room for me in this? It's perfection. It's God. So what? I'm now, as a human being, going to say, excuse me, you know, I know that it's tov me'od, but there's a few cracks there in the veneer, and yeah, there's some things I could do better. Really? You can do better than God? Really? Now, we're laughing because we know people like this, right? There are people who are delusional and believe, yeah, you know, God didn't do such a great job, you know. But the world's perfect, okay? It is. We mess it up, but God didn't mess it up. It's perfect. Let me ask, again, if everything is tov or tov ma'od even, what are we doing here? What can we possibly accomplish in this world? Where's the room for me? Where do I get a piece of the action? Number nine. Because there's one part of creation which is considered lo tov, no good. You know what it says? It says, lo tov hehios adam levado. It is not good. This is source number nine. Said the Lord God, it is no good, lo tov, that Adam should be alone. Lo tov heyos adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. Now, obviously, in the context of this verse, it's speaking of marriage. But it's not limited to marriage, because it says Adam shouldn't be alone. Man, Adam, is speaking to the universal condition of humanity, correct? It's not good for a person to be alone. We don't believe as Jews in island Judaism, right? We're not like the Tom Hanks guy and Wilson off in that castaway, and you can be a righteous guy up in the Himalayas. That's not a Jewish principle. We, in fact, it's the opposite, fakir, right? How much emphasis do we place on a kehillah, a base kinesis where we have a quorum davening? Well, we say that on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur specifically, don't daven at home. Come betochami, come among my nation. Be there, all of us together, in the power of our collective Chatanu, right? You notice how we always say this in the plural. We don't say Chatasi, Pashati. We say Chatanu, we have sinned, God. The power of the community has an enormous, enormous gravitas to it. So if so, God says there's one part of creation that I need your help with, and only one part. So what's amazing is if this is the only slice of the pie of God's magical world, where we are allowed access. And it's not an insult to say to Hashem, hey, I want to step up to the plate and be part of this. In fact, it's the opposite. It's the only place where I can make a difference. Interpersonal relationships. Bein Adam l'chaveiro. How we relate, how we connect, not just to the paradigm of a husband and a wife, but obviously it extends to family, to children, and a father, and grandparents, and grandchildren, and just friends, socially, as humanity. How do we get along? And this is not a small issue. It's not a small issue. So let's go back, please, for a second, to that second quote, which is the Rashi on Vayeshev Yaakov. I promised I would readdress it in a different light now. Okay? We said that God starts with Genesis, and then he goes from Adam, boom, get to Noah. And just fires through those 10 generations. They're literally like a list of numbers. And then again, a list of numbers, lifespans, and an important child, progeny, get us from Noah, then we get to Abraham. But let's examine the Torah very quickly, okay, in a very cute way. So God begins with Genesis. Okay, do you really have to understand Genesis? No, if you really want to know, go to school. Go learn with Professor Gans, study with him for a couple of years on an island somewhere, and learn some stuff about what Genesis really means. Because no one really understands anyways. God says, I'm going to give a short shrift. I'm going to go a couple hundred words. I'm going to use big words. You know, like there was the Tahom and there was Tovavo. It was chaos. And you can have fun with it. You want to go learn what it means, spend 20 years learning about it. But it's not really that important. And he fires it off in a couple hundred words. But Adam and Eve, all of a sudden, they're having an interpersonal problem, maybe in the garden. Let's see what's going on between a husband and a wife, the very first husband and wife. Let's slow down for a minute, and let's analyze what went wrong. Okay, let's go a little more. Oh, a couple brothers, Cain and Abel, they're not also relating to each other properly. So let's stop for some verses, and let's analyze relationship. You're going to see it over and over again. And then it goes weiter. Let's just get from Cain and Abel. We don't even learn anything about Seth, who's only our great-grandfather. Chase, all we know is that he was the third kid after Cain and Abel. We don't know anything about the siblings. Nothing. They go boom, boom, boom. But then we get to Noah. Oh, my gosh. The world's got interpersonal problems. Everyone's robbing each other. You notice they're not talking about, like, idolatry and murder, which was part of the generation of the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood. But it was the robbery that pushed everybody over. Why? Because God says, you know what, if you don't know how to respect each other, interpersonal relationships, if this is a disaster, I'm bringing in a flood. The world's going to start with water like it originally was. So again, we have this Parsha, Noah, which has only two events. Everything else are the begats. You have the event of the flood and the event of the big tower. And again, just a few verses, let's talk about the tower. Let's go on. 10 generations, meet Abraham. Three Parshas are going to tell you all about Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. Right? Because that's interesting. Because that's a husband and his wife and all the intricacies of their relationship, the dynamic, how they build a nation. Same thing. Isaac, Rebekah. Let's talk about Rebekah, who she is, who she came from. And then they get to Jacob. Parsha after Parsha. Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Laban. Jacob, right? And we go on. Jacob and Esau again. And then we get to our Parsha. Parsha after Parsha, Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, Vayechi. Four Parshas dedicated to Joseph and his brothers and their rapprochement. First, how they blow up the family, and then they finally come together in the land of Egypt at the end of the laws. Four Parshas, I'm estimating, 500 verses. 500 verses versus a couple hundred words all about Genesis. Really? So where is God putting emphasis on what is important in this world? Is it the big cosmic stuff? Absolutely not. So remember we said at the outset, Jacob wanted peace. He wanted tranquility. Why? Because I got to get down to the big cosmic things. I'm going to build a world. God says, Jacob, I don't think you understand. I built the world already. I think I did okay. I don't really need your input in there. But you know where I could use your input? How about building your family? How about building the 12 tribes with integrity, with family unit? That's where we'll start. So when he talks about Vayeshev Shalva, he wants to dwell in tranquility and get down to the big business. God says, I already took care of the big business. The only thing you can do now, Jacob, is Yeshuv. Get along. Learn the family values. That's what I want out of you. And so the Torah tells us it's inescapable. The minutiae that it goes to. So what happened with Joseph? Oh, well, he had dreams. And then he had hairstyles. He used to comb his hair too much in the mirror and twirl his hair. He was too cute. So the brothers got ticked off at him. Right? It goes through like silly things. You're thinking, who are we talking about? We're talking about Joseph? You're talking about Judah and Levi are so petty? Yeah, absolutely. If it's there in all of its gory detail, it's there because we're supposed to learn. And to learn both the bad and the good, but how to get along. And it's always been the blight of the Jewish people. Lotev Yesedan Labato, the single Jacob, an only place for you to sit and dwell. Forget about all the cosmos. That's already done. That's generic. I need you to conquer this area of interpersonal success. That will either make or break the Jewish people. If you think I'm exaggerating, remember the famous quote? Look at number 10. One of the most famous quotes in all of Talmud. When a heathen, idolater in other words, who wished to convert and become a Jew, asked the famous Hillel HaZaken for a summary of the Jewish religion in its most concise terms, meaning while standing on one foot. Now remember what Master Shammai did to that man? He picked up his baseball bat, well, a stick, that he had there. I don't know why he had it. I guess he had some students there in the basement. He had some crowd control issues. So he picked up his stick, and he chased this lunatic out of the Beis Medrash. He says, you want me to teach you Torah standing on one foot? Are you insane? And he chased the guy away, but the same guy came to Hillel. Say, I will convert on the condition that you teach me all of Torah while I stand on one foot. Hillel said, okay, go ahead, stand on one foot. So I guess the guy's standing on one foot. And he said, by the way, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow man. This is the entirety of Torah. The rest is perish. The rest is commentary. Oh, by the way, you want to come back tomorrow and learn what that means? Come back tomorrow. Great. Of course, Rabbi Akiva said it the opposite. Instead of the negative, he said, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. The klal gadol, the most important rule in the world. The only thing you got to learn from Torah, the only thing that matters is V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Love your fellow as yourself. Everything else will come around. So what does V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha mean? Exactly what we just said, right? Lo tohe yosa dam lavado. The single most important, perhaps the only area that we can fully be partners with God is in the area of interpersonal success or not. It's pass or fail in that area. There is nothing else. Number 11, to end on a positive note. So the brothers are all involved, and everyone after the sale of Joseph, they're all, how do we say it nicely? Mourning. They're sad. They're tragic. They're feeling sorry for themselves, or they're literally crying. The brothers were occupied selling Joseph. Joseph was occupied in sackcloth and mourning. Poor guy is down in Egypt. He's in jail. He's languishing. Reuven was occupied in sackcloth and mourning because he dared touch Dad's couch and move his couch from one tent to the other after the death of Rachel. Jacob was occupied in sackcloth and mourning over the death of Joseph and the loss of Shimon and Benjamin. Judah was occupied in finding a wife, though. The chapter 38 that appears in our parsha, nobody pays attention to. God was busy, too. Busy creating the light of Messiah. So through all the tsuras, through all the darkness, all the bad things that Jacob thought were horrible, and he said, how come, guys, lama hareosemli, why have you done so bad? You had to tell the guy down in Egypt, you had a younger brother, Benjamin? Really? So now you put me in this situation where I can't win, I've lost everything? Right? I'm bereft of everybody I've ever loved in my life, thanks to you guys. So everyone is sad. And God says, you know what? Why are you sad, Jacob? At this very moment, your son, Joseph, I am placing him as the king of Egypt to take care of you during the dark times. Why are you sad, Judah? You met a wife, you didn't even know who she was, her name is Tamar, and now you finally found out how amazing the young lady is. She's going to give you two beautiful kids, twins, bouncing babies. One of them is going to be the great-grandfather of the Messiah. A guy named Boaz is going to be his great-grandson, and he's going to meet that young lady named Ruth. They're going to have a child, it's going to be King David and King Solomon and the Messiah. So again, everything that takes us from that moment to the story of Boaz and Ruth, it's all about relationships, every single time, interpersonal relationships. So I want to end on a positive note that, yes, it's tough being a Jew. And it's tough because our interpersonal relationships are always tough. It's tough to navigate them. It's the most important area that we can occupy ourselves in, and we should all have tremendous success to conquer that area, to truly partner with God in that area. Shabbat Shalom.